Yes, you have to go up there. What happens if they do to me up there the things that I've been told by other people they would do to me up there? Is there anything I can do about it? And you say, no, there's nothing you can do about it whatsoever. In fact, in Merle Buckley's case, we ended up at a hearing because after he got hurt at the Callahan Center, I might be so bold as to say damaged at the Callahan Center, the State Accident Insurance Fund added insult to injury by denying his claim further on the basis that they had no further responsibility to him. So then he got cut off anyway, and we ended up having to go to a hearing to establish that his injury at the Callahan Center was a residual consequence of his original industrial injury. Now, all this bill addresses is to simply right that inequity and allow the injured worker who is mandated to appear at the Callahan Center his right as he would have when he is treating with any other physician or being provided any other facility, the right to seek a third-party claim against the Callahan Center.
Is the bill intended to subject the individual employees to liability also?
No. No, no, that we already...
Only the department?
Yes, only the department.
Would the department have any right of indemnification against the individual employees, negligent employees?
I don't think that that's been considered, certainly not by me, but I may have misunderstood your question. You indicated against other employers or employees of the department?
The negligent individual employees of the department.
Yes.
Is the bill intended to subject them to liability as well as the department?
Yes. Yes. For example, the director of the Callahan Center testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee that their physicians don't carry malpractice, and when asked by one of the members of the committee why they don't, he said, "We don't have to." That was seen as rather significant.
On page 2, line 1, it says, one of the conditions would be deliberate act of an employee or agent of the department. Our American agency law, the principal is not responsible for the acts of its agent that are outside the scope of its employees, especially deliberate acts. One of the doctors up there, or one of the treating people, decides to beat up somebody that's sent to Callahan. This would cover that.
This would cover that.
That goes against, I guess, what are the usual agency laws of agency. Is that correct?
You're correct. It does.
Why should I guess the Callahan Center of the State of Oregon be responsible for something like that?
Because it could provide a shield. To use that from the common law and say this was a deliberate act and therefore we don't remain responsible for that and let them seek redress against that individual employee. There's altogether too much of that in the workers' compensation law already.
Okay.
I might tell you all a story if you have a few moments about how the deliberate act can be. Conserved a shield. Many years ago, when fellows first started wearing their hair long, there was a fellow named Leach who worked for Georgia Pacific in its plant in Springfield. And Leach was probably the first long-haired fellow to be hired by Georgia Pacific, and he had that affected that long, long hair that would grow very stringy and wiry, and he apparently had some bit of a nocturnal life because it was his habit during every particular break period to immediately fall down on the floor wherever he was and go to sleep. And so this ended up in a great number of jokes that were played upon him having to do with this propensity on his part to go to sleep. For example, on one occasion he woke up after having fallen asleep on a pallet, and the forklift driver had slowly brought his forks underneath the pallet and brought it up about 20 feet in the air, and Leach woke up and looked down and nothing happened, brought it down. So it was a lot of jokes of that kind, and one of the foremen had a Zippo lighter that had his regimental combat crest on it from Korea, and he was very proud of his Zippo lighter, and it never failed. And one particular day he and some of his cronies came up to Leach and foreman said, "Watch me light this. Never fails. I'm going to light this son of a bitch's hair on fire." And so he flipped it a few times close to Leach's hair, and one of those long strands caught. And Leach, as usual, was asleep. Leach jumped up, and he was halfway across the plant before they stopped him, and at that point he was a human torch. And they put him out, and when Leach came out of the hospital several months later, he wanted something more than his temporary total disability benefits on workers' comp. And he found a lawyer who would sue Georgia Pacific directly, which you all know can't be done. And he sued him on the basis of a deliberate act. And our Supreme Court said that was not deliberate. After all, Georgia Pacific didn't hire that foreman to go around setting people on fire. Can't quarrel with that.
I just have a technical question. On page 1 of the bill at line 25, basically it says, while the department is providing services, the department may be found liable. Do you really mean to say while? I mean, I assume the person's discharged before they even file a lawsuit, let alone when the finding of liability is. And I assume what you mean is the department may be liable for the acts and omissions of its employees.
Correct. While enrolled at the Callahan Center.
But the liability doesn't end once the enrollment ends.
No.
Thank you.
Mr. Maligan, a couple of questions come to my mind. First of all, are you aware of any other set of circumstances or hypothetical set of circumstances in state law where the state might be providing some service or something like this, medical service or what have you, where this principle would likewise apply? In other words, I guess the circumstances are that an individual has no choice but to comply with the directive and to partake in the services provided by the state. Are you aware of any other circumstances where an individual might not have any option but to comply?
He's in prison. That's the only one I can think of.
Right.
Certainly not in the context of workers' comp, because the only thing that they're mandated, there are two elements of a mandate, and that is an injured worker must go to an independent medical evaluation or face the cutting off of his benefits. The typical is the orthopedic consultants in Portland. If the orthopedic consultants in Portland damaged or hurt the worker while he was up there being evaluated, the worker could bring an action against them. They would not be immune. But if he is sent to the Callahan Center for a much more extended stay, I mean, it's very difficult for the orthopedic consultants to hurt somebody when they're seeing them for 10 or 15 minutes. It's possible, but it's highly unlikely. But at the Callahan Center, you're going to be there quite possibly for months. And while you're there, there's an abundant period of opportunity for you to be damaged in one regard or another. Earl Buckley isn't an isolated instance. I mean, I doubt whether it's happening 200 or 300 times a year, but certainly must be happening in the dozens.
I guess the other question I would have is as to the scope of the bill. It's easy to visualize the example you've given us. Dealing directly there with an employee of the state. You use the term or agent in your workers' compensation department, and I'm just wondering if we're sweeping under or within the grasp of this bill other agents or individuals who might be considered agents of the department that would otherwise have some protection either in the workers' compensation law or by virtue of being entitled to public municipal tort liability limits.
Well, I suppose that the framers of the act in putting an agent had in mind some of the contract personnel who work for the Callahan Center and are there under some form of a contract or another, but are not directly employees of the department. I would imagine that's what they had in mind.
Other questions? The question I had was off the one you were asking about the what is an effective description of the nature of the acts and omissions which are covered here, whether the wording of that sentence should somehow be reframed to make that a little bit more straightforward.
I think it can be done largely by taking the second half of the sentence, starting with the word the at the end of page one. So essentially it would read, notwithstanding all of this stuff, the workers' comp department may be found liable, this is now on page two, liable for, you've got a call.
Why don't you try to rework that while we're down on the floor? Let's see if we can straighten that out. I'm a little troubled by that. Let's go on to the other bills and then come back to that and discuss what we want to do with the bill, even as amended. Committee will return to order while we're awaiting the typing of some proposed amendments to 557. Let's go on to the next bill, which is 715. Mr. Brunner.
Mr. Chairperson, members of the committee, I'm Frank Brunner with the Oregon Bankers Association. Senate Bill 715, as it comes to you, is entirely permissive. But we really believe that this legislation is not needed. We're, as an association and as bankers, in favor of plain language. As a matter of fact, both First Interstate and U.S. National have adopted plain language consumer contracts. The marketplace is bringing plain language to consumers. We have 35 community banks through the association and the joint venture that have adopted plain language contracts that we provide. Our concern with the bill, as you have it before you, there are several, and I call to your attention first on page 1, line 5, the term consumer transaction. It is not defined. This makes the definition of a consumer sales contract vague and uncertain. The standards listed in the bill aren't really standards at all, in our opinion. On lines 16 through 19, we have language that may well inhibit the state of the art, as we are about to know it, with computer tailor-made contracts being provided to consumers. We believe that in a very few months, particularly in the branch systems that we have in the state, the consumer contract will be tailor-made at the head office and provided to the consumer at a branch. That will result in cost saving to the consumer, but as you address margins and items 6, 7, and 8, we believe that that contract would probably not meet the test. Then we're concerned on lines 10 and 11. The federal mandated, state mandated boilerplate language is exempt. But as that changes, does it mean that each time there is a change that the contract would have to be resubmitted? And then the question about our 35 banks that are using the association program. Does that mean that we submit one contract on behalf of all 35, or do we have to submit 35 times with a $50 charge for each? Then there is the question of contracts between private parties that a law firm would draft. As you look at the top of page 2, only the seller or extender of credit may submit this contract for the good housekeeping seal of approval. What about the law firm that engages in this activity on a regular basis? Would that law firm be able to get a contract that they use certified, or would in each instance the $50 charge be assessed? We sincerely believe that the marketplace is doing a good job. We also have the question of little versus big. The larger credit grantors with more opportunity will be able to get the certification. Perhaps the smaller credit grantors will not. We don't think the bill will work. We think the marketplace is already at work, and we doubt sincerely that Senate Bill 715 will be used at all, at least by the banking industry, because of the uncertainty. And we think that the passage might well work as a disservice to the consumer. Be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Thank you. Kathy Keene.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Kathy Keene for the Oregon Retail Council. There's a consensus among the members of the Oregon Retail Council that plain language in consumer contracts is a very good idea, and as noted by Mr. Broder, there's been voluntary movement in this direction nationally over the last 5 years or so. However, not all good ideas make good legislation, as you know, and we are here to oppose Senate Bill 715 for that reason. We think that Senate Bill 715 will not really accomplish anything, but furthermore, we believe that by enacting the, quote, standards that are contained in the bill, you will be giving them a kind of legitimacy that they really don't deserve. We believe that by calling something a standard, you are suggesting that there is a kind of predictability, or there is something that can be measured relatively exactly and can be repeated. And if you will look at the standards that are contained in the legislation, I think you'll find that they fail to meet that definition. Counsel for one of our members here, Joe, of our company, has examined this bill and points out a number of concerns that I will be very brief on because Mr. Broder has already touched on them. The question of what constitutes a consumer transaction is a question that we have, which renders the definition of consumer sales contract very vague. Sears tells us that they have some 50 different pieces of paper that would meet the definition of consumer sales contract based on this definition, and some of those pieces of paper include not just credit contracts, which is probably what comes to mind, but all of their sales slips, their layaway agreements, their warranties, their service contracts, invoices for repairs, estimates and proposals, all meet the definition in the bill as it's before you. The other thing that we would like to point out, in addition to our primary concern about giving these, quote, standards a kind of legitimacy that they don't deserve because they are not measurable, is that the question of what real problem are we trying to solve here? If we're talking about some kind of unconscionable tactic, I would point out that the Oregon Unlawful Trade Practice statutes already deal with this issue by specifying that it is an unlawful trade practice in Oregon where a person knowingly takes advantage of a customer's physical infirmity, ignorance, illiteracy, or inability to understand the language of an agreement. So there is a remedy that already exists for this kind of unconscionable tactic. And are we concerned about unconscionability, or is there some other problem we're trying to solve here? In conclusion, we suggest that it's a good idea that does not result in good legislation because it isn't possible to legislate plain language standards.
Thank you. Any questions?
What was the site for that unconscionable contract?
It's ORS 646.605/8(a), b), and c.
Thank you.
One question.
Courtney?
Kathy, are you familiar with the 6 states that have reportedly adopted a plain language standard for their consumer sales contracts?
I am not familiar with the legislation in those states. I understand that the state of Minnesota does have such a statute.
So you have you discussed this with any of the Chamber of Commerce's or AOI equivalents in those states in terms of the problems it's caused and not caused?
No, I have not.
Okay. Thank you.
So Smith?
I think I'll save the question for the work session.
Jared Hill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kathy, maybe it's a different situation, but didn't the insurance industry have to, there was a law passed for plain language in the insurance industry. I would imagine that their situations are as diverse as any because of the type of things that they insure. And as Representative Courtney mentioned, we have a number of states that have adopted something like this. I guess if it's a good idea, and this is in a good way, I guess we need some help with it. And if you haven't looked at any other states, I take it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hill, I'm not familiar with what is required in the insurance industry. I'm sorry, I can't respond to that question. I am also not familiar with the standards that other states apparently are using. It's the belief of our members, after lengthy discussion, that there is simply no workable way to legislate plain language unless you are very specific about what it is you're trying to include, and we don't believe the definition in this bill is very specific. And then you need to be very specific with the standards, and so a person can look at their contract and have a pretty good idea themselves of whether or not they pass muster. And we simply don't believe it's a concept that really can be legislated unless you are very, very limited in terms of what it is you're trying to include.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Any further? Thank you. Wilbur?
Chairman, my name is Lawrence Labor, and I'm Assistant Attorney General with the Consumer Protection Services Division here on behalf of the Oregon Department of Justice. Hayes Beal, who is the primary sponsor of this legislation on behalf of the Oregon Consumer League, is here, and so I will let him speak to the merits. I'd just like to make two points to the committee. First of all, the department has been supportive throughout this process of this legislation. We had some reservations about some of the language. The A. Gross bill, which comes to you from the Senate side, includes several amendments that we offered and which we feel takes care of the problems that we were concerned about. The one remaining reservation I guess we would have is with respect to the revenue picture. Originally, the bill contemplated that this would be general funded. I think there was an appropriation of about $20,000. At one point, the Senate Judiciary Committee asked the Attorney General if somehow the certification process could be absorbed in the present budget, therefore having no general fund appropriation. The Attorney General responded that no, that was not in the cards as far as he was concerned. At that point, the Senate Committee started viewing the possibility of a fee-supported program or a fee support in some combination with the general fund appropriation. We took a look at the state of Minnesota, and I've given your committee counsel some materials from the state of Minnesota. They are one of the most recent states to adopt plain language program. They charge $50 a clatter for submission of a contract. I talked with my counterparts in that state. There's a new program. It goes online on July 1, I guess went online 5 days ago. They felt that they didn't really have a track record at this point to determine whether or not that's going to be an adequate revenue to cover the cost of the program. I think part of the feeling was that you just couldn't have a fee any higher than that and not deter small business people from submitting contracts. Our concern remains the fact that we just don't have any idea how many contracts are going to be submitted. If there are several hundred contracts submitted, I think $50 a contract will probably be adequate. On the other hand, if you take a look at some of the materials that the state of Minnesota has generated to help businesses comply with the statute and to encourage them to comply, there's going to be some significant overhead or startup costs associated with the program. And after you've expended money for legal services and forms and whatever, if you then only have a few contracts submitted, my concern would be that you're not going to have a self-sustaining program. But with that reservation out of the way, I'll be happy to answer any questions that come in.
Are you recommending something different as far as the approach to finance the committee?
We had ultimately recommended, at least I had delivered a letter to Hayes Beal, which was circulated among the members of the committee on the Senate side, suggesting that we would be much more comfortable if, recognizing that we weren't going to get the $20,000 appropriation that we were talking about initially, of having something on the order of $4,000 general fund money so that we knew we could cover the startup costs, with the hope that the $50 per contract would then cover the review of the contract. Ultimately, it was decided by the Senate committee to just rely on the $50 per contract.
Courtney?
We already have in law language, I believe, that talks about plain and clear language. If I'm not mistaken, for state ballot measures, we adopted that in 79. In 81, we applied it, required it for local ballot measures. Isn't that correct? And the Secretary of State's the one who sets the standards and reviews the respective ballot measures to see if they comply. Is that correct?
I know the latter is correct. I'm not sure of the former.
The latter being
the Secretary of State's office reviews those ballot measures, those titles. I think you're right, but I'm not sure about what kind of plain language standards.
So you don't know whether this kind of language that's in here tracks with the standard that we already set up in terms of ballot measures, state and local?
No, I don't, Representative.
You remember, Representative Lombard, I recall, you in 679, then we again in 81 did that, set that up. I refer to you specifically and Representative Rutherford because you're on Elections Committee. I remember coming before your committee, and I forget now what standard. They use some standard without putting it in the law, but I'm only saying that in terms of how detailed you'd have to go in state law to reach the point you want to reach. That's all I'm saying. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Bridget, concern about the definition or lack of it of consumer transaction. Is that a term that is elsewhere defined in statutes?
The term has been
from the UCC. What is it?
There was a reference made to the unconscionability provision in the New York and Unlawful Trade Practices Act, and that particular statute only comes into play with respect to consumer transactions, and it doesn't receive any extensive definition, I don't believe, in that statute. There have been several court decisions interpreting what is a consumer transaction and what is not. I would assume that cases decided under this provision would probably track very similar to those cases. Essentially, as treated under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, the key language is the language that's found at the end of that section on line 7, purchases primarily for personal, family, or household purposes. And most of the decisions have centered around that particular phrase, whether or not the particular purchase met that definition.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hill is anxious to talk.
Representative Hill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. The previous witness testified that it would be very difficult, if not impossible, to codify this type of an approach. Do you generally agree with that? Are any of the programs in other states far enough along to be able to say whether they're successful or not?
I'm not sure, Representative Hill. They're all relatively new programs. The only state that I've been in contact with is Minnesota, and they are not that far along. It's interesting in terms of just while I was listening to that testimony, I was looking at Minnesota's statute, and they have a standard which is really much vaguer than this. Their approach has been to say something to the effect that we just want contracts to be readable and use plain language and let it go at that, where this approach tends to try the laundry list approach of 9 or 10 specific requirements. Whether or not the more general approach or the more specific approach will work better in the long run, I don't know. I really don't know.
Do you think the approach is generally workable?
I think so. I think that I heard Mr. Bronner talk about the problems that computerization may pose. There may be some problems out there that we don't know about, but I wasn't persuaded that computerization in and of itself will pose a real problem. I think it's workable. I have, since our office is going to be charged with the certification, you know, I must be honest that that's going to put a responsibility on us that I hope we'll be able to go ahead and perform and not have one business thinking that we're taking, you know, that a competitor is getting an advantage because we were too lenient with certification in the competitor's case and not with the particular businessman who's most recently submitted a contract. So I think we're going to have to be very concerned about consistency and doing the best job that we can in terms of certifying these contracts. And it's because of that, I guess, that my major concern has been the revenue picture in that when I talked to Minnesota, I talked to them initially right at the start of the session, and they indicated that they had hoped to turn this all over to a paralegal. And their experience over the last 4 or 5 months has been that they have received contracts up to 25 pages in length. They received some contracts that were submitted with some pretty delicate legal questions. And as a result, the assistant AGs in that office are still doing the certification process after 5 or 6 months. Obviously, that turns out to be a much more costly proposition than having an administrative assistant or paralegal do the work.
If you could have the funding, are you generally supportive of going forward with the program?
The question is, does he want to take the person into actual legal and physical custody? And if you're looking for evidence of the crime, a search can be made right there at the scene of the stop for the marijuana or whatever you're looking for. What happens on a search incident arrest is the person's, all of their belongings, including their wallet and closed containers, are opened up and they're looking for them. And it's not because they have any probable cause of evidence of an offense being found. It's just strictly once you have seized the person, you have seized the possessions, and it would be reasonable to make a search. Now, the State versus Carraher case here in Oregon has kind of clouded that issue. We don't know what the Oregon standards are going to be. But the federal standards, if a lawful arrest is made, a search can be of anything on the person for evidence of any offense, not necessarily the offense which the person is being taken into custody.
So the bill narrows when arrest would take place?
Yes, it narrows it to the person where there's a reasonable doubt as to the person's identity. And all that's being told to the officer is, my name is Jerry Cooper, and there's an address and date of birth, and that's all the officer has to work with.
Thank you, Jerry. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I've discussed this with Jerry Cooper as we went on the call. And here's a concern of mine. On page 3, section 11, it's at lines 24 and 25. About a person knowingly using or giving a false or fictitious name, address, or date of birth. And I asked Linda if there was a definition of a false or fictitious name. Here's some situations.
I think we're about at the group of judiciary bills, and I'm having trouble getting my quorum back, so we'll pick up, hopefully briefly, with 380 and 557 right at the start of the 7 o'clock hearing. And so we don't need to carry them to another day. Just leave everything up then.
Okay. We'll stay in recess then until 7 o'clock.
We're right back.
Is this the one here at all?
No, so it's a recess. You can actually use that.
But gave the incorrect date of birth. They would be in technical violation of this, I believe. The other thing is, my wife, when we got married,
you're pretty deep representation.
Yeah. Well, my wife laughed.
Before I started backing up, you know, getting up about where I'm going.
How long have you been married?
Oh, 6 months. My wife, speaking of when we got married, my wife got one of these hyphenated names deals.
Who gave it to her?
She dreamed it up, I guess. But her name is, her actual name is Gropper hyphen Scavera, but she uses the name now Barbara Scavera, and she's getting in the habit of using Barbara Scavera. And if she gave that to a police officer, you're saying I sent your case right there, but she would be giving a false name. And I don't know how to word this, and I don't want to make this not enforceable because it's too complicated. But it seems to me that we should have some intent factor in there, that a person gives this name, I don't know, gives a false name with the intent to hide their true person or something like that. I don't know if that would make the case so difficult to prove that the DAs couldn't go forward with it or not. But in other words, what I'm trying to differentiate those people that innocently give wrong information and those people that are trying to hide themselves from the law, the true person from the law.
Well, I would think that if it's now worded, it would cover that. Knowingly uses or gives a false or fictitious name. I think if you made a mistake in the sense of you had a hyphenated last name, hyphenated surname, and you gave only part of it, I wouldn't think that would violate this law.
Mr. Chairman, knowingly under the criminal code means awareness. You're very much aware. There's no inadvertence. It's intent means consciously striving for an end result, but knowingly means acting with awareness of your conduct.
You're thinking a person that meeting a police officer and they said, "What is your name?" and they gave them the name they usually go by. That would be more the result of habit or something rather than knowingly giving it false.
If what they gave was in fact their name or you know, part of their name, I would really find it hard to believe that that would be considered a violation of this. But I stand to be rebutted on that.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if there are any Oregon State police officers here, but I would surmise my experience, again, in just Washington County, is the only people ever taken into custody for violations are people who cannot be properly identified. Officers are not using this today for abuse, but the potential is there, and you've got the State versus Brown problem, where nobody would desire to have the courts rule that you have a right to a jury trial and proof beyond a reasonable doubt and a court-appointed attorney. Obviously, violations have almost the exact same definition as an infraction. They're not intended to be anything more than punishable by a fine or a forfeiture. But not no jail sentence of any type, and the original proposal by Metropolitan Public Defender's Office, or they were with the group that was proposing, was just strictly the officers could not make a custodial arrest, period, nor could an arrest warrant issue for a violation. Well, that leaves the officers out in the cold. They just basically would have to say, "I'm issuing this citation. If I'm not sure who the person is, then I'm just not going to issue the citation, and we'll just have to forget this offense," because they do not want innocent people, again, brought into the system by way of an arrest warrant. And the word gets out. I'm very much convinced of that, and that's why in the traffic area it's so important. If there's a means of escaping, either facing the music, or if you are a person who, if there's an arrest warrant for you, and the officer cannot reasonably ascertain your identity when you're stopped for something like a violation, and of course people are not going to give a true name. They're going to memorize someone's true name, and the reason for the date of birth is they might just slip up and give a date of birth that doesn't even come close, and that has occurred. They know the name and address, but the date of birth they're fuzzy on, and then they've got problems.
I'm going to call the house